There has to be a movement of women in capitalist countries, in communist countries, in third world countries, and in the United Nations.
That was feminist writer and American women's movement leader Betty Friedan speaking in 1975 at the UN as events for the first ever International Women's Year gathered pace toward the first historic World Conference on Women in Mexico City that June. The General Assembly set three ambitious goals for the year: promoting equality between men and women, integrating women into economic development, and strengthening peace. I'm Matt Wells here at UN headquarters in New York, 43 years on, and we're going to take you back to that moment for this edition of our podcast classic series, when the women's movement was battling male scepticism, if not aggression, and male-dominated institutions, striving to be even heard on an equal footing. Elizabeth Reid was the first ever national advisor on women's affairs appointed by Australia's Prime Minister. She was blunt about the challenges facing her pioneering generation of mid-70s feminists.
I think the first thing that can be said is that women are the oldest colonised and underdeveloped group in the world.
In a moment, we'll hear from one of UN Women's in-house historians on the significance of this watershed year for the gender equality struggle. But first, here's an edited version of six special shows produced by UN Radio in early 1975, surveying the state of womankind. It's only right we credit the writers, producers and presenters Sylvia Levitan and Roger Belden.
Half the world is woman.
Half the world is woman. Until now, kept out of the way. But she's coming out now, has things to say. And without a doubt, she'll be up and away. 'Cause it's the dawn of a new day.
This is United Nations Radio, with the first in a series of programs devoted to International Women's Year, 1975. Equality between men and women was proclaimed a principle in the United Nations Charter almost 30 years ago. Over the years since, it has been spelled out and reinforced in various declarations, conventions and resolutions. But what are the realities of today?
The face of the liberated woman, the contours of her character, are a complete mystery to us. She does not exist any more than does the liberated male.
That's how the Australian feminist Germaine Greer describes the present situation. Britain's Janet Cockcroft takes it a little further.
Women's talents are not being utilised, except in small measure, in any part of the world. Nor have women and girls been generally granted equality of opportunity or treatment with men and boys.
Some of the dimensions of the problem are pinpointed by Amadou Makhtha Mbo, Director General of the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. We quote from a recent message of his.
Of the estimated 800 million illiterates in the world, 500 million are women. Although women make up between one-third and one-half of the workforce, the overwhelming majority of them are concentrated in low-paid jobs.
But hasn't there, in fact, been a great deal of progress in the last few years? The answer everywhere is yes, but, as illustrated by Father Anthony de Souza, an Indian Jesuit on the World Council of Churches.
And today we have a woman as the Prime Minister of India. On the other hand, I do grant that there are a lot of changes that have to be brought about.
Ruth Jacobi, First Secretary of the Swedish Foreign Ministry, tells what is happening.
In some countries, women are still fighting for equal legal and political rights. But even in societies that have formally granted equal rights to men and women, the struggle is far from over. Whatever UN resolutions may call for, or national laws may prescribe, economic realities, values, norms, and prejudices constitute obstacles that will take time and effort to remove.
We bring you some of the views expressed in a panel discussion of the plan of action being prepared for the International Conference, which opens in Mexico City on the 19th of June.
Mrs. Helvi Sipilä, the Secretary General of the conference, has emphasized one basic cause for the lack of action. women have not been involved in the planning and decision-making. But this does not mean that men are completely to blame.
If women in most countries today have political rights, what have we done with these rights? Maybe we have just taken them as a right, but not as a responsibility.
Haven't women, in fact, throughout history, taken on revolutionary roles along with men, fighting with the same guns, enduring the same hardships?
How come that when the struggle is over, their companions, they send them back to the kitchens to cook their dinners and to wash their socks?
That was Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci. And here is the Argentine psychoanalyst Mari Langer.
In Cuba, for instance, they were not sent back to the kitchen. Deep down, this is a problem having to do with economic relations as well as production.
U.S. author Alvin Toffler saw the next 25 years as turbulent ones marked by a super-industrial revolution involving not only technology, but a transformation of the entire social system.
And it seems to me that the worldwide movement for a change in sex roles is a part of this historic transformation that I think will touch every conceivable aspect of our lives over the next 25 or 30 years.
But that's not quite how it seems to Elizabeth Reid, personal advisor to the Prime Minister of Australia.
It seems to me that no political revolution is ever going to achieve anything at all for women. And I must say that I totally disagree with Mr. Toffler, and that the revolution that women require is something quite different.
Nor is it the view of Germaine Greer, Australian author on women's affairs.
I'm a firm believer that one can never be liberated by anyone but oneself. But on the other hand, you can't undertake it as an individual either. It's a question of the collectivity.
But Soviet astronomer Alla Masevich stresses quite a different point.
The most important thing are the economical problem. Technology can do a lot of good, especially for women.
Till we begin to set priorities that relate to making this a human society, the whole business of economics gets us into the bag of simply acquiring more of the things that make us less human.
And that was Margaret Wilson, chairman of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in the United States. Yet another thought from Ghanaian High Court Justice Anihiaga.
In the developing countries, the problem is simply this, that women have had years of traditional attitude that affairs of state are not matters for women.
The question is how to bring women into the positions of leadership and power that will allow them to share in decision-making. Why is the Australian feminist writer Germaine Greer pessimistic about the outlook, at least for the next quarter century?
Because most of the governments who are in fact represented at the UN are characterized by having a silent majority, which is female.
But Anihiaga is much more optimistic.
Now, it is true that at the moment, most positions of power are in the hands of men. But women are coming up, and they are breaking this down.
And Britain's Janet Cockcroft has some words of advice.
Let us remind ourselves and others that we women are not a minority group. In the United Kingdom, we have recently witnessed the election for the first time of a woman as leader of a major political party. But when the momentary elation had passed, we realized that such events should not be a 9 days wonder, but should be expected.
Some have wondered why, given the rise to power of such women as Indira Gandhi and Golda Meir, it has not yet been possible to have a female Brezhnev or Ford. Soviet astronomer Alla Masevich feels that this is not the crux of the problem.
A large percentage of women should be in the governmental work where they really can do something. But for a big country, one person is nothing.
Mrs. Masevich points to the heavy representation of women in her government and emphasizes that education is the key. But Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci looks at the situation from another angle.
We all know that the vote of women is exploited, but we always forget that one reason why there are so few women all over the parliament, all over the world, is that women do not vote women. Why?
We quote here from a reply given by Madame Jean-Martin Cissé of Guinea.
We, the women, must change our own thinking. And let us start by showing far greater cooperation among ourselves.
Yes, there has to be a movement of women in capitalist countries, in communist countries, in third world countries, and in the United Nations.
That was American feminist Betty Friedan. But Father Anthony D'Souza, an Indian Jesuit on the World Council of Churches, raises another question regarding women's liberation movements.
We have to ask ourselves, not merely liberation from what, but also liberation for what. We must not think of ourselves as rivals, men and women. It has to be conceived as a partnership.
Leticia Shahani of the Philippines agrees, but raises another issue.
While we should not look on equality as something as the battle of the sexes, I think it must also be recognized that women have suffered.
With two-thirds of the world afflicted by poverty, malnutrition, illiteracy and disease, increasing attention is being given to the question of how to bring the long-neglected resources of woman power into the struggle for better conditions of life. What of the millions of women, mostly in rural areas, who know no way of breaking out of a cycle of constant childbearing and back-breaking work as they struggle for sheer survival for themselves and for their families? Father Anthony D'Souza, an Indian Jesuit on the World Council of Churches, highlights one aspect of this problem.
There are, for instance, the developing countries in Asia where the woman, as a woman, does not have respect. But as a mother, she has respect. So the attitude of the girls is to get married as soon as possible and to have a child as soon as possible. This is the thing that we have to change.
Mahnaz Afkami of Iran sums it up this way.
Development in its true sense cannot take place without the full participation of women. Women cannot, however, play their role unless there is some degree of development first, especially in relation to attitudes and prejudices.
As legal and other reforms are gradually breaking down some of the tangible barriers which have prevented women from assuming equal rights and responsibilities, another kind of obstacle, perhaps the most difficult, is being faced. It concerns attitudes. Mrs. Sandlund of Sweden gives a concrete example.
We cannot successfully claim an equal participation of women in the production and in political life and trade union activities if we at the same time are demanding women to have the full responsibility for home and children.
Mrs. Kubota of Japan agrees on the need for a more equitable sharing of responsibilities.
When both man and wife have jobs, the tendency is the wife bears greater burdens, both physically and psychologically.
This calls for a radical change in the traditions and attitudes, and a new perception of the sex and family roles in society.
And that was Ruth Jacobi, first secretary of the Swedish Foreign Ministry, who emphasizes that changes in the traditional female role imply changes in the traditional male role.
The need for these far-reaching changes applies to developed and developing countries alike.
Ghanaian High Court Justice Anijaga agrees, but she sees the struggle for equality between men and women as part of a broader commitment.
I don't think that this world will be destroyed by an atomic explosion. I think it will be destroyed by the explosion of injustice. And that is why the question of the liberation of women is so very basic, because it is a manifestation of injustice. And if it goes, other manifestations of injustice must go with it. The unjust world economic situation must go with it. The unjust racial discrimination must go with it.
And so, International Women's Year continues to engage the attention of governments, organizations, and individuals in a campaign to promote awareness and in a plan of action on behalf of equality, development, and peace. Among recent signs of progress,
Democratic Yemen has outlawed polygamy. France has a new abortion law. Mexico has approved an equal rights amendment to its constitution.
But she's coming out now, has things to say.
And this is United Nations Radio. The song, Half the World is Woman, was written and sung by Jacqueline LeMay.
So that's where the discussion over women's rights stood in early 1975. To put it all into some kind of context and discuss how many of those hopes and aspirations have been realised today, I'm joined in our podcast studio here at UN headquarters by Sylvia Hordosh. She's a policy advisor for UN Women, the UN's agency dedicated to gender equality that in many ways grew out of the whole legacy of International Women's Year in 1975. Sylvia, we've got to start, I think, with the haunting reference we've just heard there to democratic Yemen, where in early 1975 the government outlawed polygamy. Now, of course, it's one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a woman.
Correct. This shows how progress is uneven. Some countries make tremendous progress, and then you have armed conflict, natural disasters, you name it, and the situation can change. But the fact is that since 1975, women globally have made tremendous progress.
So that's the headline?
That's the headline.
And just put into context why this year was so important. I mean, obviously, you know, we've heard just there some of the watershed moments that occurred. One event that had yet to take place when those recordings were made was this seminal conference in Mexico.
It started out with the Commission on the Status of Women celebrating its 25th birthday. And the Commission on the Status of Women is the main body within the United Nations to focus on women's rights and gender equality. And out of the Commission's work came the idea of declaring the International Women's Year, just focusing on women's rights. There was a sense for a need for an international year. And so we had the International Year declared, the first World Conference on Women in Mexico. And then there was a sense a year wasn't enough. It became a decade. It became the decade for women. And then followed by the second World Conference on Women in Copenhagen in 1980, Nairobi in 1985, and then in 1995, the fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. And the Beijing Platform for Action is still the guiding document for us at UN Women and for gender equality advocates across the world that provides us with policy recommendations in a very wide range of issues, looking from poverty, economy, health, education, media, human rights. All these issues are covered in the Beijing Platform.
Was there a sense that this was the year, therefore, when women's rights really took off and women were, for the first time, not just sort of recipients of attention and policy formulations and declarations and actually became, you know, started to become equal partners in the decision-making process of bodies like the UN?
Yes, and I would also add that this is the time when you have a whole new wave of women's activisms, women's movements across the globe.
So these women were really reflecting the culture and the cultural moment that we were in 1975.
And the sense that not enough had been done, and so women were rising up and saying, we want to enjoy our rights. We want to have access to education, to the labor market. Remember, 1975, there were some prominent universities in the U.S. that did not yet allow women.
There was this figure that kind of leapt out at me from the tape there, that there are 800 million illiterate people in the world. It was said 500 million of whom were women. Has that proportion got better?
Well, it's interesting. I looked that up. Interestingly enough, it's still 500 million women who are illiterate. But of course, there are lots more of us here. So we have made progress. The Millennium Development Goals helped, and certainly the Sustainable Development Goals are working.
The Millennium Development Goals, just to remind people, those are the goals that were set in the year 2000. For a 15-year cycle of development.
Right, and which had a strong focus on education, which helped make progress in countries. But as of today, we still have about 15 million girls of primary school age who will not make it to school compared with 10 million boys who are not in school. So girls are still lagging behind in some progress. Then you have situations, say, in the Caribbean, where educational outcomes for girls and women are very good, but then these outcomes do not necessarily lead to good jobs.
So again, that just shows that that in order to really fundamentally change the opportunities for women, you've got to really look at a sort of quiet revolution, a slow revolution throughout the whole of society and national economies as well, to try and truly create an equal playing field.
You need legal frameworks, you need policies that have the aim to achieve equality. One of the issues that in the tape we heard did not come up, which has been very visible since, is the issue of violence against women.
When did that first become an important factor?
Well, I think the women's movement started talking about violence against women starting in the late 60s, 70s. Remember, we had to tell people that domestic violence, violence in the household, in the family,
was wrong.
Is wrong. It took us till the year 2000 that the Security Council discussed for the very first time the impact of armed conflict on women and girls. And one of the most horrific impacts is violence against women.
I mean, why do you think it took so long for it to get onto the table?
Male delegates here at the UN discussing priorities at the national and global level. And for a long time, we were keeping the private and the public very separate. And so what happened in the family was not being discussed. And I think that's an example of very clear progress. But as you see here in the US, for example, through the Me Too movement, what we are seeing right now, that women who come out and say, this has happened to me, whether it's in the movies or in my office space or in sports, it is happening and the discussion is changing. There's one issue that I'd like to raise that I think came up in the tape also. The work that women do in the home. The longest time we have taken it for granted that women do this work. This work is not measured, is not valued. It doesn't show up in national statistical systems, although there are some changes. And the reality is that the work that women do unpaid limits their opportunities to do other things, participate, run for politics, go out and have a paid job.
Yeah. Be in public life. In any capacity. Public.
And this is a new promising debate that has gotten a lot more attention, and there's more of a discussion of what is the responsibility of governments to support households in terms of infrastructure. If there are no childcare facilities or elder care facilities, women risk becoming the default solution. But if we think of societies of the collective responsibilities and see the constraints that women have in participating in political life, in the economy, and take measures to develop public services, then
that can support them.
We can support them, and women can engage much more actively in discussions, whether we discuss climate change, peace negotiations, or macroeconomic policies. Women can be at the table. A greater diversity of voices will also lead to a greater pool of solutions. So we will all benefit.
Do you think that if some of the women that we've just heard were kind of around the table here now with us, do you think that they'd be sort of surprised and generally pleased with the progress that's being made? Or do you think there are things where they would perhaps wonder what went wrong?
I do think they would be pleased to see the progress made, but they would also recognize some of the problems they raised themselves.
They wouldn't be surprised that they hadn't yet been solved.
Yes. They would look into parliaments and see, oh, they're still not 50% women. Or if we were to tell them that we still have a gender pay gap, they would say, oh, you still haven't resolved that? But they would also be surprised that we have tackled issues that they didn't discuss at the time. As we mentioned, violence against women, the whole issue of unpaid care work.
And just to sort of move on to what your own personal reaction was in terms of listening to that tape, did it make you think about how your own feminism evolved?
Yes, it made me think of how important it was throughout my life to make women visible. To recognize the achievements of women. I've heard the story in different variations, whether it's with Maggie Thatcher or other women leaders, where you have two kids playing with each other and the boy says, oh, when I grow up, I'll be prime minister. And the girl says, no, you can't, because that's a woman's job. And of course, if you have role models, you can aspire to think big for yourself. If you are told as a little girl, no, you can't do this because women don't run countries, women don't run big corporations, women can't do certain sports, it limits the potential of people. And I think the biggest change I have seen that barriers for women have fallen in my lifetime. While I'm aware that there are still countries in the world where women might need the permission of a husband to go and see a doctor or to buy property, those examples are becoming fewer and fewer. I mean, back in the mid-70s, women in Europe or the US needed a husband to get a credit card or open a bank account.
We forget just how simple things like that really have changed for the better.
Yes. Some achievements are fairly recent, even in countries that think of themselves as leaders in gender equality issues, no?
And as you say, in terms of things like the battle for reproductive rights, there's a great danger that things can go back, can regress very, very fast.
You still have tensions between breaking pathways for women to enjoy all their rights and to fulfill their potential, and tendencies to control women, to limit their own control of their bodies, but also the control of their minds and their ability to participate in their societies.
So we all have to be vigilant, both men and women.
Correct.
Sylvie Hordosh, thanks so much indeed.
You're welcome.
That's it for this latest podcast classic from UN News, bringing you the highlights from our unique and historic audio archive. You can find more treasures from the vaults by going to www.multimedia.org/AV Library/. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening.